United States v. Whiting. Mr. Bertocchi.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Joel Bertocchi, and I represent the defendant in this case, Stephen E. Whiting. The central theme of this case is the gross disparity between what the government chose to charge and what it proved at trial and relied on, and what was relied on by the jury and the judge at sentencing, at trial and the judge at sentencing. Now, not all disparities between charges and proof are fatal, but in this case, the disparity pervades this case, affecting issues of liability, sufficiency of evidence, evidentiary rulings, and sentencing. The government in this case selected and charged very narrow technical offenses, but then they ran away from those offenses as fast as they could. They tried the case on an uncharged fraud theory that improperly broadened the range of admissible evidence and that ignored the specifications of the charging statutes. The result was a faulty theory of liability, insufficient evidence, an unfair trial, and a grossly illegal sentence.
Well, so let's get right to the heart of Mr. Bertocchi. Why, when an employee gets his paycheck at the end of the week or month or whatever it may be, and a certain amount says deduction for health plan or deduction for 401k plan from his gross pay, why isn't that an asset of the welfare benefit plan in question or the pension benefit plan?
Your Honor, in a given case it might be, but that would depend on analysis of something that the district court in this case specifically excluded from consideration, which is the, in this instance, the collective bargaining agreement.
Why is the collective bargaining agreement pertinent if the employee is told you're not going to get X dollars of your money because we are putting it in this other plan for you?
Your Honor, it's pertinent because of the language of the statute covers plan assets. And what plan assets are, for two reasons. One of them is that the language of the statute covers plan assets. And it requires an examination of the document that creates the rights and obligations of the employees and the company in order to determine what are plan assets. In the second place, even if you can characterize them as plan assets, it's also necessary to look at these documents to determine whether the employee, whose interest is sufficient to allow for a conversion. And if you take a look at cases like Thebus and Lawson, they talk about the fact that a future interest in possessing money or in having money spent a certain way is not sufficient to give rise to conversion.
But I'm not sure this is a future interest. We can come back to the other point, but it seems to me you have a present interest in your money winding up where the employer tells you it's going to wind up.
Your Honor, the conversion cases define very specifically what the interest, what type of interest is susceptible of conversion. It's a possessory interest or a future possessory interest.
Your theory really is you can't have a possessory interest in money, I think.
No, Your Honor.
No?
You can if you have it given to you.
So is it they have to be dollar bills with like little X marked on them, or
well,
what?
Our theory is that conversion involves specific piles of particular dollars.
And but why haven't these been defined as specific piles of particular dollars by looking at the pay stubs at the end of the period?
Well, Your Honor, they have been defined in that way, but there's no indication, that the employees had the possessory interest in them that would allow you to say that their money was converted, and there's no indication in this case that they were converted from the plans because the district court foreclosed that inquiry by deciding as a matter of law that as soon as the deduction was made, they were plan assets. The collective and the Lasky case is a great illustration of this. The Lasky judge relied on documents that specifically talked about what was supposed to happen with the money that was withheld and how it was to be held and by whom. The collective bargaining agreements in this case did not support that sort of creation of a trust. But even if they had, it didn't make any difference because in his pretrial motion to dismiss ruling, Judge Randa precluded consideration of the collective bargaining agreements.
But was there any dispute at all that when deductions were made from the employees' paychecks for these two purposes, I guess 401k was just one of the two companies, but that was the money that was the employee contribution to the relevant plan, the health plan or the retirement
plan. No, I don't think there was any dispute as to that, but that doesn't mean there wouldn't have been a dispute as to whether that money was a plan asset or ever got to the plan.
Well, unless you're saying, though, that it has to be almost a particular marked bill, I don't see why defining a certain amount of money as now equitably belonging to the plan is a problem. I mean, if you've defined it as equitably belonging to the plan, maybe almost a constructive trust or whatever you want to call it, then the plan has been deprived of an asset if the money doesn't wind up there. The money didn't wind up there.
Not if the asset never became a plan asset. The statute doesn't protect employee assets. It protects plan assets.
Right, but at the moment it's deducted. At the moment the employee is told, you know what, you earn $1,000 a month, but we're only going to give you $950 because the other $50 has to go to the plan. The employee now doesn't have. It's not like the employee gets the money and then gives it back to the plan, right?
And that's why the employee never has. That's the second issue, which is why, because the employee never gets the money and is never going to have it, the employee never has the possessory interest or future possessory interest
but
that you have to have.
But he's paying taxes on it.
In conversion cases.
In many ways, it is considered his money.
But the statute doesn't cover his money. The statute covers plan assets.
No, but I'm just saying it's his money, then a certain amount gets deducted and is allocated to the plan, and then he gets the rest of it.
Your Honor, I think you're assuming the answer to the question by saying it gets allocated to the plan. In this case, it remained in the general operating account of the company. But if it didn't get to the plan, it doesn't become a plan asset.
So under your theory, it is impossible to have a violation of 664 if it's just money, as opposed to, expensive paintings or something.
Oh, it's certainly possible. It's certainly possible. Lasky is a great illustration of that, because in Lasky, certain legal documents conferred on the money a particular status, which then made it convertible. And that's what the judge said. In Lasky, the documents created a trust and said that the defendant held them as a trustee. But that was an examination of specific documents that was precluded by Judge Randa's ruling here. He just said as soon as it is deducted, it's a plan asset. He never even talked about what the plan was. The indictment suggests that the plan is the insurance companies, the health insurance companies and the strong funds that did the 401k. The money certainly never got to them. The most they ever had was a contractual right to receive the money. And if that's all they had, a future contractual right to receive money can't be converted. What you do have to do in a conversion case is follow the dollars.
But if you divert the dollars from their intended recipient, say the United Health, and you put them in your own pocket instead, it seems to me you've converted them.
Well, you haven't. I think under the language of the statute, they have to get to United Health. If United Health is the plan, as I think the government means it to be, it has to get to United Health in order to become their asset. The conversion cases say that you cannot convert something unless someone has a possessory interest in it or a future possessory interest in it. And if the future possessory interest is contractual, the conversion cases say you can't convert that interest. So conversion does follow money. What I think you're reacting to is the notion that somebody ought to be on the hook for this somehow if this is what really happened in this case. And it may be that there was a conversion from employees, but the statute doesn't cover conversions from employees. It may be that there was some form of theft or fraud, but that's not what the government charged in this case. They selected conversion, and conversion has all kinds of rules and all kinds of specifications.
Well, let's just be more precise. They selected the statute. The statute uses the word abstracts or converts. And
the indictment uses converts.
Actually, who embezzles, steals, or unlawfully and willfully abstracts or converts to his own use. So there's a whole slew of things.
There is, but they selected the conversion part of it in the indictment.
And it also covers money, funds, securities, or assets of a plan or any fund connected therewith.
Well, Your Honor, the connected therewith theory appeared in the government's brief in this court. It was never argued to the district judge. It was never argued to the jury. The jury was never instructed on that point, and so the verdict certainly can't be seen to reflect any kind of a finding by the jury that the government proved that there was a fund connected therewith anywhere. And that's a pretty critical aspect of liability in terms of conversion, which is something I think you just can't gloss over and say it all comes within conversion.
No, I mean, I think that you're right in that the government's theory is that the minute these deductions occurred from the employee's paychecks, those funds, $50 in my example, automatically became assets of the plan. That was the only place they could go. The plan was the only entity that could have any interest in it, and everything else was just shuffling paper around at that point. As I understand it, that's the government's theory.
I think that is the government's theory, Your Honor, but the problems that the theory has is that conversion is a possessory cause of action, and that there was not even any inquiry as to what the plan was at trial, because it was precluded by the pretrial ruling and the jury instructions, which said these are plan assets, without telling the jury what the plan was or could be, or without telling them to take a look at the document, which is the only source of any rights and obligations in this case, on the part of anyone, on the part of the employees to contribute, on the part of the employer, the ability to take the money and then do something with it. It all comes from the collective bargaining agreement. And you can't answer these questions without reference to that. There may well be cases, and I think Lasky is one of them, where the scenario you're talking about could properly be charged under these statutes.
Mr. Bataki,
this case is not that, Carmen.
You're into your rebuttal. You can do it if you want.
Your Honor, I will take 2 minutes to cover two additional points. Regarding the wealth evidence, I think that what takes this case out of the garden variety Rule 403 abuse of discretion ruling is the way the government handled the evidence. It is one thing to say, to convince the district court to exercise its discretion to admit evidence of wealth, and particularly of personal expenditures, which don't add anything to the question of where the money was going, which is what conversion is about. And say, we will use that evidence for this purpose. That's what happened in the Quattron case, and that's why the Second Circuit was willing to swallow the admission of that evidence despite its acknowledged potential for prejudice. What takes this case out of it is that the government didn't follow through. And this is a burden that they had, a burden to use the evidence explicitly in the proper way. And I think for that reason, I think the court in analyzing prejudice has got to consider that. Finally, at sentencing, I would emphasize that Judge Randa was exactly correct when he said that no but-for causation had been shown. His mistake was in not recognizing that the inevitable legal consequence of that is that you cannot attach uncaused loss figures, regardless of foreseeability. For that reason, a resentencing is necessary in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bataki.
May it please the Court, my name is Gordon Giampietro, and I represent the United States in this matter. I think Mr. Bertocchi's presentation has, in fact, crystallized exactly the disagreement that the parties have with respect to 664. Under the defendant's view of the law, the issue here is whether an employer can avoid criminal liability under Section 664 by never applying employee payroll funds for the ERISA plans for which they were intended. That is clearly the party's dispute in this case. The defendant's narrow construction of Section 664 is inconsistent with its broad language and the special fiduciary duties that are the very purpose of ERISA.
But, Mr. Giampietro, as I understand it, the instructions that the court gave to the jury were consistent with the government's view of the proper reading of 664. So what we have before us is a question of law as to whether that's a correct view, and if we thought it was not, obviously we would have to have reverse.
Yes, of course, Your Honor. The instructions that the court gave with reference to the regulation that's at dispute in this case were a correct instruction with respect to the law of ERISA. 664 has words in it that need to be defined for a jury. The jury clearly has to understand or be instructed as to what these terms mean. And so the reference to the regulation was a correct statement of the law, in the government's view, necessary for the jury to actually deliberate on the charges in the indictment. So when I say that the dispute in this case is, it's really this, Judge, the government's position is that employee payroll funds are, in fact, plan assets when deducted from payroll.
So always, without exception, the minute that deduction happens, they become the assets of whatever the plan is designated on the employee's pay stub, health, retirement, disability,
well,
whatever.
To be fair, Judge, they are under the regulation. It indicates, and I'll read it for Your Honor, the regulation provides, I I have not brought it with me, but in any event, Judge, what it indicates is that employee payroll deductions intended for an ERISA plan are plan assets as soon as they can reasonably be segregated, but in no event greater than a certain period of time.
This is the regulation you all are arguing about as to whether it speaks or not to criminal prosecutions.
That's right, Your Honor. So, yes, they are plan assets if they are intended for an ERISA plan. When they are deducted, they are plan assets.
What is this reasonable period? I mean, what's...
Well, that's the difficulty, Your Honor, and why there's that parenthetical in the regulation, because the Department of Justice was concerned that that is a vague phrase. But what the drafting history indicates, Judge, is in a case of clear conversion, which is this case, there's not a concern. I mean, this is not a case where the funds were converted on the 16th day or the 91st day for purposes of a welfare benefit plan. So the drafting history indicates that in a case like this where there's clear conversion, and there's no dispute, certainly as to the 401k funds, there's no dispute that those monies, those deductions, ever went to the strong funds. So, Judge, I understand there's that vague phrase in the regulation, but this is not a case where that's a concern. Whiting's proposed instructions under 664 in the district court were clearly in error. For example, they're in the record at 61. Whiting wanted the jury instructed that employee funds were placed when they were placed in the general operating account of the company are assets of the company rather than asset of the ERISA plan unless the collective bargaining agreement made him a trustee. That's clearly not a correct statement of law. Judge Wood, as you indicated, those are the employee's funds. They are a possessory interest in those funds when they are deducted from payroll. The question here is if the collective bargaining agreement, the employer promises, I will submit these to the plan, under the defendant's version of 664, the employer has to further promise, and I really mean to do it. That's really the defendant's argument here.
Is the specific plan something that should be considered by the jury?
Judge, in this case, the jury did consider that the collective bargaining agreement required, there was a contractual obligation for the defendant to get that money to the ERISA plan.
Was the plan put into evidence? Was it offered into evidence?
Yes, Judge. The collective bargaining agreements
entire
for both
plan.
Badger Dye and Western Rubber are in the record. Yes.
What was precluded that Mr. Pataki discussed?
What he believes was precluded is the fact that they could not argue to the jury their legal theory that there needed to be this special entrustment language in the collective bargaining agreements. Clearly, the judge's legal ruling that was consistent with what the government was proposing, it precludes the legal argument that the defendant wanted to make, that the collective bargaining agreements had to have entrustment language. And I think it's important to distinguish, Mr. Bertocchi mentioned the Lasky case a few times, there is a world of difference between employer funds and employee funds. As the government indicated in its brief, when an employer promises to contribute to a plan, one can see why there has to be entrustment language as to the employer's funds, because otherwise that could simply be seen as a breach of contract rather than a conversion. When
that
we're
is
talking
to say
about
it's his money, and so that his promise to put the money in is subject only to a contractual obligation, not a criminal violation.
When we're talking about the employer's funds, no. That's right, Your Honor. The employee's funds are an entirely different category, and I think take it out of the Lasky decision that the defendant relies on. Mm. Importantly, this rule of law, or the instruction that the government requested here, is consistent with both the Bannister case from the Fifth Circuit and ITPE pension funds cases. The Bannister case, and I'll just briefly quote from Judge Garza, in situations like this, the company is acting as a mere steward and may not dip into the plan assets to use for its own purposes any more than it could dip into the private bank accounts of its employees to fund its shortfalls. That's clearly what happened in this case. The ITPE pension funds case further clarifies that in contexts like this, there is no need for a particularized agreement to that effect that the funds are held in trust. The regulation governs that sort of situation, the situation we have here. If I could move on to the sufficiency of the evidence arguments in this case, they don't
relate. Would you mind jumping ahead to the sentencing argument? Because I'm very concerned about the language Judge Randa used about but-for causation. And your brief struck me as kind of a rearguard action, trying to sort of find it, even though the judge had said he wasn't going to find it. But there's a big difference in the amount of money for which Mr. Whiting's being held accountable.
Yes, Judge.
Is it your position there's no need for but-for causation? And if that's not your position, how can we do anything but remand, given what the judge said?
Judge, I would first indicate that, no, that's not the government's position. There clearly is a but-for requirement. That's clear from the amendment to 2B1.1. The question is, how much teeth does the but-for requirement have in this kind of a context? And I guess with respect to that, I would just read for the court the two paragraphs from the drafting history, which I think are critical to that. And in particular, what the commission indicates is that the application of this causation standard in the great variety of factual contexts in which it is expected to occur appropriately is entrusted to sentencing judges. And the commission further says that it's determined that this standard better ensures the inclusion and loss of those harms that reflect the seriousness of the offense and the culpability of the offender. And I guess what the government's position here is that the but-for element of 2B1.1 is not the sort of strict but-for cause that would be required perhaps in a different context,
context. Where do you get language from Judge Randa, at least, suggesting that had it not been for these statements, which is what we're dealing with in this respect, somehow losses of this magnitude would have occurred? For example, I mean, even under the government's theory, eventually the employees do learn that these are self-funded plans with simply an administrator to shuffle money around, not actual insurance plans. I mean, what's the language from Judge Randa that you think saves you?
Judge, I would admit that the sentencing transcript is not exactly as clear as the government would like. but I will say this, the judge...
Tactfully put, I will say.
I think it is clear, though, from the transcript that the judge is concluding, based on all the evidence before him, that the employees of these companies did, in fact, rely on Mr. Whiting, and they relied on the fact that they would be provided for. Is it nailed down precisely to counts 10 and 13? Not as well as perhaps the government would like, but I will say that that's why I have relied now on the sense that this but-for causation is not as strict at sentencing as it would be in a different context, like a tort context. What the judge was doing, I think, Judge, here, was in fact consistent with the commission capturing the criminal conduct here and really finding a way to punish the defendant for his conduct. And I would go on to say, Judge, the government did argue before Judge Randa that this was an appropriate case for an upward departure under Application Note 19. And I think that although Mr. Whiting asserts that that's a frivolous argument, I think not. I think the judge heard all the evidence in this case and considered the severe emotional trauma and the fallout from this conduct. There's no doubt, Judge, from the record, that the employees did not, in fact, know officially from the company that they were self-funded until the end of 2001. In fact, official notice did not come until March of 2002.
Weren't people being informed in twos, or though? I mean, it seems like a lot of people did know
what they were
earlier than that.
Actually, Judge, what they were being informed of in twos was the sign-up process in June of 2001. That was the process whereby they got their MBA cards to use then with providers. Those cards did not indicate that this was a third-party provider. They still understood, based on the notice, that MBA was an insurance carrier. So the two-by-two issue comes in June of 2001 when they're advised of the program. They did not know they were self-funded, Judge, until they were confronted, or Teresa Polkowski, the personnel officer, was confronted in late 2001, and then official notice of self-funding did not come from the company until March of 2002. So I think there is sufficient evidence of reliance in the record here that counts 10 and 13 led to the losses that the judge assessed.
I'm not sure what you mean, though. I've been sitting here pondering what you mean by this looser but-for causation. So I've been thinking of, you know, nursery rhymes about for want of a nail, the kingdom was lost and things like that. I don't know. I mean, but for the fact that we were all born, nothing would have happened. But that's never been thought of as good enough for but-for causation.
Yes, Judge, I understand that. I think what I'm relying on is the fact that Amendment 617 to 2B1.1 was intended as a broadening of the loss, the definition of actual loss in the guidelines. I don't think there's any dispute. I mean, this court itself for a while held that consequential damages were not captured within the meaning of actual loss. That was done away with this amendment. And so what I'm trying to suggest, Judge, is that this language in the amendment, the commission is saying this is the kind of thing that district courts are going to have to wrestle with and apply in the unique circumstances before them. And this is the kind of case where these employees And the judge seized upon this. The corporate culture was such that they trusted the defendant. They believed that they were covered. And then they believed, when they found out they were self-insured, that he was going to follow through on it. And I think that's what Judge Randall was getting at when he talked about the corporate culture at these companies. So that's why I'm saying it's not a strict but-for cause test, Your Honor. I'd like to address the sufficiency of the evidence arguments and then the wealth evidence. With respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, the challenges are to counts 1 and counts 5 through 9. Counts 3 and 4 are not challenged. Count 3 is a 664 count. Count 4 is a 669 count. As this court has indicated, a sufficiency of the evidence challenge is an uphill battle all the way. The evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict. Count 1, as you know, is the deductions from employee payroll in June of 2001. There's no dispute it never went to United to pay the premium for June. It never went to a self-funded plan because that plan didn't begin until July 1st. So there's more than sufficient evidence in this record upon which the jury's a rational juror could convict on count 1. In addition, there's evidence in the record that the defendant was able to pay himself significant amounts of money in June and July of 01. So again, a reasonable juror could certainly have convicted on count 1. The same is true with respect to counts 5 through 9, the 401 counts. And again, these arguments are really not sufficiency of the evidence arguments, but please accept the defense that the jury rejected. For example, the defense here at this court and also before the district court and before the jury was LaSalle Bank was keeping me from forwarding the 401k funds. It's LaSalle Bank's fault. It's Randy Lubin's fault. It's not my fault. The jury, there's evidence in this record of significant payments going to the defendant in that relevant time frame. So a rational juror could clearly have convicted on counts 5 through 9. And again, so I think the sufficiency of the evidence arguments, both as to counts 1 and counts 5 through 9, are unavailing, and really the defendant wants this court to accept arguments that the jury rejected. On the issue of the wealth evidence, as the government indicated in its briefs before this court, it is incredibly overstated how much evidence came into this trial with respect to wealth. There are perhaps a handful of exhibits out of about 120 exhibits that related to personal expenditures of the defendant. There are probably 5 pages of transcript out of 1,000 that related to the defendant's expenditures. And so to suggest that wealth evidence pervaded this trial and gave this jury, inflamed this jury to convict on class bias, I think is not supported by the full context of this case.
And your relevance theory for the wealth evidence was what, intent to convert? I mean, apparently he had plenty of money anyway, so.
Well, Judge, I think you have to look at it in the context of what the defenses were in this case. I'm an honest businessman. I buy businesses and I turn them around. The businesses were struggling. The government responds to that by saying the businesses were struggling because you sucked them dry of all of their funds. That's why they were struggling. And at that point, when you needed to choose between keeping the doors open of the business and converting employee payroll, you chose to convert employee payroll. That's the theory upon which this evidence was introduced. I also think if the court is trying to determine whether the jury was unduly prejudiced by this evidence, you have to consider the acquittals on count 2, counts 11 and 12. That is significant. That suggests a jury that is actually fairly weighing the evidence presented to it and not inflamed by any appeals to class bias. And if you read the government's opening statement and closing argument, you won't see any appeals to class bias. There's no effort to taint this defendant as someone who should be convicted merely because he's sucking lots of money out of the business. That's to demonstrate the intent to deceive or cheat the employees out of the employee funds that were withheld. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the convictions be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. You have 7 minutes, Mr. Bertocchi.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the but-for requirement of causation in sentencing has all the teeth it needs. It is a separate and independent and additional requirement to foreseeability. And nothing in the amendment or in the treatises or cases that govern this indicate anything else. If but-for causation is not shown, the money cannot be attached at sentencing. In this case, Judge Randa specifically found, and admittedly the transcript is not particularly clear in other areas, but it is clear here, not only that he found there was no but-for causation, but that he chided the defendant for focusing too much on something that was in fact required. I think that the government is wrong when it talks about that amendment being something that was designed to take into account the seriousness of the offense. The offense in this case, the only money involved in the charges was the $66,000 that Mr. Whiting was converted. When the district court uses the foreseeability requirement to attach another $830,000 plus to that sentencing guidelines calculation, that is not simple, that is not broadening. In fact, the foreseeability requirement is designed as a limitation on but-for causation.
Are you worried at all, Mr. Bertocchi, about a remand in given the fact that this is the post-Booker regime and Judge Randa has already shown his willingness to impose a more stringent sentence?
Am I worried, Your Honor? Is that what you...
Yeah, right.
No.
I mean...
No, Your Honor, I'm not worried about a remand in the sense that... this was a post-Booker sentencing in the first place.
Right, I know, and he went up 12 months above what the top of the range was.
Well, but if the top of the range goes down to 33 months and he goes up 12 months from that, and I'm not suggesting
right,
that we would
concede
that was
proper.
Right,
but I'm wondering if he went up back up to 90. I mean, you know, obviously well, you'd appeal again, I assume, and try to convince us it was an unreasonable sentence, but...
Yes, Your Honor, we would.
And within the statutory maximum.
It's within the statutory maximum, but I can't imagine that Judge Randa didn't make all the findings that he was ever going to make. His dislike of Mr. Whiting was patent on the record, and I can't imagine what other findings he could make at another sentencing. But if that happens, it happens, and we'll appeal. But no, given the disparity here, we're not worried about that at all.
Okay.
In addition, Mr. Giancantro talks about evidence of reliance, but he proclaimed quite loudly to the jury that there was no evidence of reliance proved at trial and then never added anything at sentencing that would have allowed the judge to believe or even in some sort of melded foreseeability and but-for causation standard that there was any reliance. And, in fact, there was not. What the judge was animated by in this instance in sentencing was really what Mr. Giampietro talked about today, the corporate culture, which was really, if you read the transcript, the corporate culture that preceded Mr. Whiting's coming into the company, which A, is not criminal, and B, he had nothing to do with, that they trusted him. What Judge Randa essentially did is put Mr. Whiting in the position of being strictly liable in a criminal case for whatever consequences the employees suffered as a result of anything that he did, whether it was legal or illegal, whether it was the offense conduct, relevant conduct, or as what really happened, something that the government and Judge Randa simply did not like. I'd like to move on to the sufficiency of evidence arguments and Mr. Giampietro's discussion about those. And he talked primarily about count one. The theory of count one is premised on, and his argument was premised on, the notion that in June, that money never went to United Healthcare. Well, of course, because of the district court's pretrial ruling, we don't know whether United Healthcare was the plan. The jury was never allowed to consider whether United Healthcare was the plan. And the statute refers to plan assets. But putting that aside and moving on to sufficiency, there is nothing in the plan or the collective bargaining agreement, which was in evidence, that suggests that the money had to be spent in a particular month. There, undoubtedly, Badger made a number of expenditures during the course of June of 2001. In addition to paying Mr. Whiting his fees, they paid employees' salaries. They paid for aluminum to die-cast things out of. They probably bought office supplies for the front office. All of those expenditures took place.
But they didn't pay United Healthcare.
Well, if United Healthcare is not the plan, then they're not required to.
Well,
then they're not converting when they don't.
May I stick my oar in? Because I want to know, there's a dichotomy between the two. What was kept out of evidence of the plan that you are complaining about?
Nothing was kept out of evidence, Your Honor. The collective bargaining agreements, as Mr. Giampietro says, were admitted into evidence.
Right.
What was precluded was the jury looking at those to determine what plan assets were. And the way it was kept out is that the judge instructed the jury that that as soon as the funds are deducted, they're plan assets. The collective bargaining agreement said different, but there's no reason without a jury instruction that the jury would look to the collective bargaining agreement to make that determination. So the evidence was there, but what would have led the jurors to look at it for that purpose?
Was the question of whether it was an asset a question of law or a question of fact?
I think ultimately it would be a question of fact. It would be informed by proper jury instructions on when something becomes a plan asset, but ultimately it is something the jury could have determined.
The instruction you're complaining about is the judge telling him what the plan was?
Right. He is essentially directing a verdict on that issue.
Isn't that a matter of law, though? Whether it was an asset or not?
No, it's not, Your Honor. I think it's something. Well, let me put it to you this way. I don't believe my first response is no, it's not. It's something the jury could determine by looking at the collective bargaining agreements if they were told, as the defendant wanted them to be, that that's what they should do. But in addition, the judge in advance of trial precluded it as a matter of law from being considered. So both the legal determination and the jury instruction, which eliminated the possibility of a factual determination, precluded that consideration. Yes, the jury had the contracts in front of them, but they were not told to consider those, and they were not told to consider that because of an error of law in eliminating from their consideration the only document that would have defined what a plan asset is. And the statute only covers plan assets. It doesn't cover employee funds. The government went on at great length at trial about he stole from the employees. Maybe somewhere in the world there's a statute that says you can't steal from employees. But the government didn't pick that statute, and the government didn't charge that statute. It chose a statute that depends on plan assets. And then the district court, acting at the government's instigation, precluded consideration of whether these were plan assets from pretrial consideration or consideration by the jury. It may be that in the end the evidence wouldn't support a determination that they weren't plan assets, but the inquiry was never made. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Bertocchi. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.